At this time, I'd like to introduce our guest speaker for the month of December. Tonight, he will be sharing his story and his personal experience with Steps 1 and 2, and that's Billy N. from Landing, New Jersey.
Hi, good evening. My name is Billy Noonan. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Billy.
And it's good to be out here tonight. I welcome anyone here who's new to AA, might be coming back here for the first time, or just here to see if this is for you. If you are here to see if it's just for you, I urge you to stay until you hear someone maybe talk. Don't do what Billy did. Don't judge the messenger. If you spend your time like me for a long time waiting to hear someone who looks just like you tell your story, my experience is that that doesn't happen a lot around here. It didn't happen for me. My experience is that more often than not, people who look nothing like me, who dress different than me, who are raised in much different places than me, told my story. But the problem with that is that if your mind is as closed as mine was, and still can be, then your ears don't work. And that's a very dangerous combination for an alcoholic of my type. It's a privilege to be asked to speak anywhere. And, it's funny, I have lots of thoughts going through my mind. I read directions carefully. I was told to share my experience, strength, and hope, my personal story, and to focus on steps 1 and 2, and to not quote from the big book and not read it. And that's great because, I truly am one of those people who feel that reading the big book is a one-on-one, and I mean one with one other person who's been through the steps. Quoting a big book from the podium never helped me any, truthfully. Sitting down in a diner or in someone's living room, that really has helped me. What I've gotten from speaker meetings in my experience has been hope. And one of the things I think I like about my early recovery is that I was so out of it. I heard your life was really bad, and now it was really great. I don't ever remember people talking about the kinds of problems that I run into in sobriety on a daily basis. And I think that's maybe God's way of protecting you. Because I'm not sure if I had really heard all that stuff that I would have been as open to staying around here. My life resembles nothing of what it used to look like. I mean nothing. Yesterday afternoon, and I like that this meeting says that no one speaks for AA, because I definitely don't. And I'll try to stay away from opinions, because I really feel they kill people. If I say something, it's my experience. It's something either I've done that hasn't worked. I find them to be the best tools of instruction for people I help. Nothing better than telling somebody how I did the exact same thing and how horrible and disastrous the results were. But I also can share some experience of personal things I've seen and haven't seen. In my sobriety date is January 5th of 1990, this sobriety date, and that's the last one I hope I want. And there's a lot of things that go around AA that talk about continuous sobriety and the person who got... I know that I'm not in a popularity contest, and I know certain things that I've been taught aren't popular, and I'm okay with that. I do not believe the person who got up the earliest in the morning is the most sober. Let me talk about my early introduction into AA, because I was a teenager. Somebody the other night asked me, of all the things that I've heard in AA or that I believe, what things really had the most effect as a newcomer? And for me, I really have to say that acting better than I feel is definitely one of the things that helped me the most, that I had to learn to act my way into right thinking. Number two was that a kick in the ass is always a step forward. I've never forgotten that, you know? The person who said that a long, long time ago, it might have sounded harsh at the time, but it's true. For me, a kick in the ass has never been backwards. It's always been forwards. But I'll talk about my early endeavor into AA, and I always like to use two tables, the uncool table and the cool table. And The cool table, wherever you are, in a Friendly's or a Howard Johnson's or some diner, the cool table is the people that I like. They wouldn't crack open a big book if it was the last thing available to them on earth. They're definitely not going to have a sponsor. They learn early on, if your life is like mine was, that learning AA lingo can be very useful, but you don't need to know the principles behind it. You know, when you are being interviewed by attorneys and probation officers and task officers, that it is good to be able to throw out the lingo. You know, you learn that those who know the lingo, they get an easier time. You know, it's good to be able to throw it. Yeah, I was at a beginner's meeting. I stayed for the step meeting. You know, I have a 12 and 12 and a big book. I have a sponsor. You know, when you start learning those things, you can make it appear to people that you know what you're talking about. And it's so funny when I see it today, when I see that going on. But I can just talk for me that the cool table knows all that stuff. The cool table knows the benefit of being affiliated with AA, but not even really wanting to stay here. Now, the uncool table is like my worst nightmare. I remember the first anniversary meeting I made when I was like 16 years old. AA anniversary meeting. I had never been to one before. When I saw grown adults singing Happy Birthday, I thought to myself, this is exactly what I thought AA was and why I will never stay here. I mean, it was like every fear I ever had about AA come true. You know, seeing these grown adults with a cake, with candles, and everybody singing. I mean, it just really reassured me that AA was not the place for me. At 16 years old, you know, the uncool table, they do things like make their bed in the morning because their sponsor tells them to. They say things at the meeting like, I had nowhere to go today, but my sponsor told me I should get up and dress like I did anyway and go to the first AA meeting I was able to go to. The uncool people would say things like that. You know, I would not want to get up past earlier than 4 o'clock in the afternoon after a good night of drinking. And I thought AA was scared straight. I thought that this stupid television show my mom had me watch when I was a young kid about these inmates in Rahway and scaring these kids, I thought that's what AA was. I thought that there were a lot of older people, there weren't too many young people, and I really thought that you just were going to ruin my drinking by scaring me. And what I've learned about that, to fast forward very quickly, is that I do not stand here today, not a half or a hundredth of 1%, because I'm afraid of the consequences of drinking. I can tell you that honestly. The consequences of drinking have never stopped me from drinking, ever, ever. They just never did because I like to drink, and I like not to feel. The only reason I've stayed in Alcoholics Anonymous is because of I've started to learn how to live sober. I've started to like being uncool. I've started to like believing in a power greater than myself that every day gives me the opportunity to stay sober. Those are the reasons I stay sober. Scare tactics don't work for me. You know, if I ever owned my own country, my special forces would be alcoholics because you just can't kill us, you know? I mean, you ever hear some of these stories? You know, you sit in the back of the room, you have a cup of coffee, and you're like, they got to get sober now, for Christ's sake. Come on. You know, and like, and then they drink again, and then you're like, all right, they're getting sober now, and they drink again. Our resilience to physical pain is absolutely mind-boggling, in my opinion. You know, I was thinking, you know, I ran to the bathroom quickly before here because I forget all the time that I only have one kidney. It's not something I remember all the time. I just, you know, in my high school yearbook, I went to my first AA meeting because it was told to me that it might be a good idea. And there's a couple of things about Billy that I should tell you. Right from the get-go, sounded like a good idea at the time has been a mantra of mine that has brought me nothing but horrible pain and suffering. Sounded like a good idea at the time, even in sobriety, sometimes has come back to haunt me. The other thing I know about my brain or my head or my thinking is that nothing lives longer in this head than a bad idea. I mean, it's just the truth. You know, a good idea, something that sounds right, that those come and go. Bad ideas, my head is a headquarters for them. And, you know, when I was going to AA meetings as a teenager, and I don't know, there could be somebody here that drank before they came here tonight, or there could be someone who's planning on drinking after they leave, and I want to tell you that I am not here to judge that. I truly believe that God works in God's time, but I also believe that if you have a window of sobriety of a day, that day may never come again. I really believe that. I really believe today that when God opens up that window, you know, I've been in lots of meetings where I hear people say welcome back and thank God, and they go on this litany of what they've done for the last 30 days or 3 years, and people say, oh, that's God's will. I don't believe that. I don't believe that if I walk out of here tonight, drink, and decide to stick someone up, that that was God's will. I believe God's will for me is to be a sober human being and to act the best that I know how and to strive to get better. I know that if I close that window in time, that window in time when I pick up a drink has very little chance of opening. And I'm not about to really mess with God these days. I've tried, believe me, and as the weeks go on, I will explain to you exactly when I have tried as hard as possible to step in God's way. You know, for me, I was saying yesterday, humility is such a funny word in Alcoholics Anonymous, and everyone has their definition, and you know, everyone has their favorite step. But for me, I just need to remember this. Everything good in my life today is a direct result of Alcoholics Anonymous and God. End of story. No matter what is going on in my life today, I need to remember that but for the grace of God and Alcoholics Anonymous, I would not have it. You know, yesterday I went to see a person. I was in Los Angeles on business, and I went to this homeless shelter, and my company, you know, and anything I say, please don't take it, you know. When we travel, my company has this deal with this national company, and if it makes more sense not to rent a car, then they have drivers take us places, and you know. So I pulled up in front of this homeless shelter in this black Lincoln Town Car with smoke windows in my suit and tie, and got out, and I'll tell you, I was like, it's beyond my belief sometimes what Alcoholics Anonymous is capable of. I have met more, I used to say I needed to believe in miracles. Today I know I depend on them, but the reason I think my faith in God is so strong is a direct result of the steps and a direct result of witnessing people's lives in Alcoholics Anonymous. I personally know that there are certain things that are not physically possible for humans to do or to get past. And when you see people, and a lot of times it's harder to see it in yourself, but when you know where people come from and the kind of, you know, precarious situations we like to get ourselves in, and you see them get over them and get sober, that, to me, my belief in God rests really on my witnessing miracles. And then, staying sober a little while, I have seen people go through the hardest, and the reason I talked about continuous sobriety is that if this was about getting up the earliest in the morning, then I would do that 3 days a week, and the other four I would drink, because that's what I wanted to do when I came here to begin with. If it meant that as long as I got up earlier than you this morning, I was the most sober, and I did that a couple of days a week, and the other days I drank, I would really, that sounds attractive to a guy like me. But here's the other thing I know. Over the last 12 plus years, I have had tragedy in my life. I have had circumstances present themselves that are, at first, my thinking might say God punishing me, but I know it's just life. And there's a meeting on the Upper West Side called Chelsea Riverside, and the nickname is Chock Full of Nuts, and if you ever get a chance, go there. But I heard a guy say a long time ago, welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous, not Rose Petals Anonymous, and I didn't really know what that meant at the time. Its significance never really hit me until I started going through trials and tribulations in sobriety. And the reason I talk about continuous sobriety as a result of working the steps is that when my mother was diagnosed with cancer, I needed to be able to talk to someone who's gone through something like that without picking up a drink. When my dad died suddenly after burying my mother, I didn't want to talk to someone who went out and grabbed a pipe and a bottle of Jack Daniels, because I don't want that. My experience in Alcoholics Anonymous is that my heroes are not the perfect in sobriety club. They're just not. My heroes are the men and women who have stayed sober through God's grace under the most trying circumstances. And, you know, as the weeks go on, I will talk about that when those circumstances happen, I will grasp for anything to want to survive. But in the end result, if I'm not grasping towards working with a newcomer and the steps in my life, everything else I grasp only brings more pain, and there's only a temporary fix. And, you know, so I went to these meetings as a teenager, and, you know, my drinking, let me just say, I grew up with Black Sabbath and, you know, Ozzy Osbourne and Led Zeppelin, and I was a heavy metal person, and I didn't know whether to hang out with the heavy metal people or the jocks. And my house was a nightmare, and that doesn't make me an alcoholic, and I have to say that clearly. But I don't want to be foolish enough to believe that the house I was raised in, I had to take a lot of time in Alcoholics Anonymous to unlearn a lot of things before I was even capable of learning proper living skills. I was not raised with the 12 steps and 12 traditions as guideposts in the neighborhood I come from. You know, where I come from and the kind of family I come from, there's 42 first cousins, there's lots of aunts and uncles. Everybody is either a cop or a fireman, a union electrician, a wire-lather, you know, a pipe fitter, works for the transit authority. We live in a neighborhood that's surrounded by people like that. My dad was a raging alcoholic, and, you know, I have no problem saying that. You know, some people say, well, you can't kill somebody else. Well, all right, my dad died of the family liver disease. Does that sound better, you know? You know, I mean, I don't know how do you... He was an alcoholic. Drank like an alcoholic like me since he's been about 15. And one of those guys who became a very decorated police officer and undercover narcotics agent. And outside the house was a hero to everyone, inside the house a terror. And in the house I grew up in, there were but a few rules. One was that you never talked about anything outside the house that happened inside the house. That was really the rule of all rules in my house. And I remember one time being on a school bus stop telling the kid next door, dad coming in the night before, the fighting and everything, and I guess he told his mother told my mother told my dad, he kicked the you-know-what out of me, and I learned that that is, above all, a golden rule, that, you know, what happens inside those walls stays inside. And I was able to equate alcohol with trouble early on, probably from the age, I would say, of five, at least seven. You know, in my house, it would be typical for my dad to be missing for days at a time because of the kind of work he did. But it was also typical for him to be missing after he got paid. And, you know, I can tell you this, you know, before I even picked up a drink, I was taught a lot of things about alcoholism. To this day, I can't ever remember being in a bank with my dad. Not one day. I've tried. I've tried to really think. Now, I say that because growing up in my home, payday was a big day, because if my dad wasn't working that day, we would drive in and pick up his paycheck, and He worked in this office that had a special underground entrance so the undercover agents couldn't be seen, and my dad was my hero, and we would get his check, but we never went to a bank. We would go to, like, Patrick's Pub in Queens or T.J. Markham's or some Irish bar, and my dad would cash his check. He would pay his tab there. We would stop at, like, three other bars. He would pay his tab. I remember him telling me from, like, a young age how he would cash his check and he'd take money and say, "You see this? Mom doesn't know about this. This isn't my money." You know, I remember from a young age, the rules that I was taught about interpersonal relationships are so bad. I mean, sometimes I watch some of those crazy TV shows about, you know, Doc Phil and all those other things, and I think, you know, my dad would be like a case study for like 8 years, you know, every day, 8 years. You know, by the time I was 10, I knew how to get a box in a Super Bowl pool. I knew how to play all games of darts. I knew the rule to pool. You know, I was one of those kids who hung out with everybody else's alcoholic dad's kids and played pool and drank Diet Cokes and ate pretzels and VFW halls and Knights of Columbus halls and Irish bars and played with the softball, you know, was the bat boy on my dad's softball team. You know, my dad was my hero, and as an alcoholic, the only time I could really be present with him is when he was drinking. And I know today that doesn't make me an alcoholic, but a few things that he taught me were not productive in my life. You see, the kind of people my dad hung out with, the guys who, like, came home from work and deposited their checks in banks and coached Little League and volunteered at the Boy Scouts to see, they weren't men. That's what I was taught. They had sold out. They'd caved in. And, you know, what I've learned in Alcoholics Anonymous today is that most of what I was taught means being a man has nothing to do with being a man. And most of the things I was taught that make you not a man have more to do with being a man than I was ever taught. I mean, that's pretty true. You know, my house was filled with racism, anti-Semitism, sexism, you name it. We hated everybody. I mean, that was like the family mantra, you know? You know, it would be common to go out my front door and my mom would stop all the kids, and we weren't allowed outside, and it'd be like 6 o'clock, 6:30 in the morning, 7 o'clock to go out and get our bus, because there'd be three state police cars behind my dad's car, because for the last 20 miles leaving the city, he had just held his badge out the window and refused to pull over. He was as arrogant and stubborn, as obnoxious as you could ever imagine, and because of what he was, how good he was, and what he did for a living, he got carried for a long time. And, you know, when he would come home at 5 o'clock in the morning, I just remember being with my sister and my two younger brothers huddled in the downstairs living room or somewhere praying that we wouldn't hear a gunshot. Like, that's what we would worry about, you know, that Dad wouldn't shoot himself or Mom. Mom wouldn't shoot Dad or shoot herself. I mean, that's the kind of house I was raised in. Now, again, I stress, that doesn't make me an alcoholic. But if I were to listen to people to tell me that how I was raised has never affected me, then I would be lost. Because I can tell you after many inventories that many things that I learned and witnessed have affected my behavior up until today, me speaking here. And, you know, believe it or not, I know it was strange for this young alcoholic, but everybody's not raised the way I was raised. I mean, to me, I'm out sometimes near children, and I think, oh, my God, you know, how I was taught to behave. And another rule I was taught was that when we would go, when you're Irish Catholic and you have 42 first cousins, the springtime is like it's like an event on the weekends. You know, it's like every weekend is like a christening or a first communion or a confirmation or a high school graduation. It's like, with 42 first cousins, there's just something going on every weekend in the spring, you know? And those were big drinking fests. And in my family that men do not give up the keys to the car. That's just like another golden rule. Giving your keys to your wife is a sign of weakness. And, you know, if you go to a Noonan family party back in the 70s, what you would see is you might as well think you're at an Orthodox Jewish family party because the men are here and the women are here, you know, and never should the two commingle. And my Uncle Frank, the poster child of alcoholism in my family, would have one, a number to the bookie for the football games after Thanksgiving and New Year's Day, and poker chips, and he'd have like 100 singles and rolls of quarters, and the games would start. And by 10 or 11 o'clock at night, what I would witness before I even picked up a drink is either my dad or one of my uncles would be in a physical altercation with my mom or one of my aunts over keys and giving keys up and testing the manlyhood. And, you know, I don't know how to define my first drink. You know, my parents got divorced, which I've described behavior that is so barbaric on my dad's side of the street. But I tell you that for my mom, would have never left him. He left my mom for a woman he met working, and people just don't get divorced where I came from at that time. They just stay together. And things were bad, and I hated my mom for forcing my dad to leave, and I run into a lot of men in Alcoholics Anonymous who, I always sympathize with the active alcoholic. I read an article in the paper, and I'm feeling sorry for the active alcoholic. But when my dad left, I tried everything. I tried Boy Scouts. I tried sports. I tried not coming home. I just hurt. And that hole in my stomach that I had in my whole life was getting a lot bigger. And I didn't know what to do about it. And when I describe my first drink, there's a lot of things that don't count where I come from. I mean, sharing a beer with your dad at Yankee Stadium is not a first drink. I mean, that's, to me, not my first drink. Playing bartender for my dad, my uncles, is not my first drink. You know, what happened to me is that this young boy, in so much pain, in pain his whole life, feeling different, hating his mom right now because his dad left, hating his dad because his dad left, but hating his mom more. One night is in the back of like a Duster or a Monte Carlo in a 7-Eleven on Long Island and gets his first 8-pack, his own 8-pack of Miller 8 ounces. And that 8-pack changed my life. That 8-pack showed me that there was something out there that would work. It wasn't Boy Scouts. It wasn't sports. It was drinking. And it was alcohol. Because when I drank, I felt equal to you. And the more I drank, I felt better than you. And I'm a big fan of being better than. It's something I have to watch today. You know, I like to be better at anything. And I can look back now. Is it possible for a 15-year-old boy to be a full-fledged alcoholic? I've had people in AA tell me, oh, it's not possible. I beg to differ. I know the Big Book talks about the potential alcoholic also, but I know for me, I was a full-fledged real alcoholic as described in the doctor's opinion at age 15. And as I look back on my life, there are many things I can look at that I know now that I didn't know when I first came into AA. But having been around a while and had the ability to look back in my life, I can identify things that made me different. You see, when you're 15 years old and 16 years old and you're going to a keg party with like four or five other guys in a car, and, you know, when you're going to a keg party in high school, if there's going to be one keg, they say there's going to be three. If there's going to be two, they say there's going to be five. Everything is, like, exaggerated to the fifth, you know, power. But be that as it may, when I'm in the back of that car and everyone's going to a keg party, they're okay. You see, if I'm in the back of a car going to a keg party, and I don't have my own 8-pack or 6-pack to bring with me, I go into a panic. Now, some people can call them a panic attack, whatever you want to call it. I call it sheer terror. Because for me, at age 15 or 16, what I can't imagine is being someplace and running out of alcohol in the middle of the night. To me, there's nothing worse than that. You see, as a young alcoholic, there were two really bad sounds that I can identify as the top two bad sounds. A is a siren. That's always a bad sound when you're a young alcoholic. And B is, you know, the empty black tube coming out of a keg. You see, but for other people, they can be in the back of somebody's parents' house in the backyard and the keg goes empty and they're okay. To me, that's sheer panic. I'm the guy who needs to put an 8-pack of Miller or a 6-pack of Michelob in the bushes outside the house, on the side of the house, so that when the kegs end, I know I have them there. I'm the guy who, as the night goes on and I go to the refrigerator, I need to take a beer or two out at a time. When I'm taking one for myself, I'm putting one up in the tinfoil drawer or one in the Tupperware drawer or, you know, anywhere so that they won't be where other people can get them, you know. But the problem is that I've been a blackout drinker my whole life, so I got a lot of people busted, you know. Yeah, my parents found out I had a party. They found a beer in the Tupperware drawer, you know. But, you know, my drinking from age 15 on has two particular characteristics that I identify now that, you know, other people really don't have that don't have this disease. One is that I can be out for a 12-hour run, blackout at 11, wake up the next day at 2 or 3 in the afternoon, and the night before could be total horror. But in that night before, I may have identified a half hour or hour where I was on top of the world, where I thought everybody wanted to be like me, where I thought all the guys were afraid of me, where I thought all the women wanted me. I can identify a time period, a little time period, where I felt great, surrounded by 13 hours of complete disaster, terror. But my alcoholism goes out in search of that half hour, completely voiding out that to get that half hour, I have to have the other 12 hours of misery. The other thing is that I can go out with 10 people and the next day have 9 call me and say, you know what, Billy, you crossed the line last night. You pushed it. I can't be with you if you're going to do that anymore. And I can have one person call me and say, you know what, Billy, that was the craziest thing I ever seen last night. And I'll go with that person all the time, you know. I'm all out to be crazy, all out to prove myself, to separate myself from other people. And whether it's coming back from, like, a Ranger game or wrestling at the Garden and climbing on top or trying to climb on top of a Long Island Railroad car or, you know, whatever it may be, that separates me. And, you know, today I'll tell a quick story of my first step in recovery, and that is that a couple of years ago I had a couple of knee surgeries, and my doctor told me, he asked me how many nights a week I was playing softball. And I said, well, I'm just in two leagues. And he said it would be a good idea that, he said, Billy, you're 33 years old, and you might just want to stop playing softball. And, you know, you just had a second major knee surgery, and you're not going to, you know, he's pretty funny about it. You're not going to make $5 million a year, and it'd just probably be better off. And I said, okay. And I was walking to this AA picnic a couple of years ago in Chicago, and I moved there when I was 6 years sober, and I was walking down Lakeshore Drive to this picnic grounds, and I saw, like, this baseball diamond outlined, you know, like a makeshift baseball diamond, you know, a pickup game. Somebody's hat here, somebody's jacket here, you know, for bases. And the first thought that went through my mind was, well, the doctor wasn't talking about pickup games. He was talking about league, you know. He's talking about league, you know. And that day, I was in left field about 2 hours later, and there's a guy up at BAT who I didn't like, and I've had that ability my whole life not to like you and never met you. I mean, I've had it in AA for a long time. You know, you go up and get a cup of coffee, I've never met you, and I just have this feeling that I don't like you. And chances are, jealousy usually is always involved with me not liking you before I've ever met you. Number one, the guy up at BAT was good, maybe better than me. How could I even justify that in my mind? Could there be somebody better than me in softball? I mean, my mind is a terrible thing. And he had hit a really good ball the first time he was up, and he was good-looking, so they had double strike against him. You know, he's really good, and he's good-looking. I really can't stand this guy. And he hit a wicked line drive to left center field, and anyone that's played baseball as long as I have, or anyone that's played baseball like in T-ball, would know that it was going to drop right behind the shortstop, and on one hop, it was going to be a throw to second base, and a runner would stop at first. And, you know, that night, as I was limping to my car, anyone that has a bad knee knows that once it goes bad, all you do is touch it, and it bleeds. You know, I had blood caked on my sock and my leg, dried blood. I had just for 2 hours had a bag of ice taped around my knee because it had swollen up so bad. I was limping. I couldn't wait to get in the tub, you know, and soak for like an hour. And the only thing that went through my mind was that that might have been the greatest catch I ever made, and it's worth all this pain, you know? Like, that's what my mind told me, you know, that that is the greatest catch I've ever made, and it's just like my drinking, you know? It doesn't matter. I live for that small, small window of time where I look the best or things are going my way, and I shut out pain and misery. And, you know, I did that drinking, and I'm not one here to say that I never had a good time drinking, you know? My boss is 2 years older than me. We've probably identified a couple of times when we were probably out at a place in the Hamptons called the Bawdy Barn a few times together. The Bawdy Barn is a complete catastrophe. Things that happen in the parking lot there on Sunday afternoons just... I used to go with my cousins down to Belmar. They were from Staten Island. And, you know, I had some good times drinking. But those good times were so small, and the older I got, the bigger and bigger distance between those good times. And, you know, I heard a guy say at an AA podium just like this one when I was about 17. He said he didn't get hangovers anymore because he didn't drink a day at a time. And that caught my attention because, you know, I would go to Robert Moses Beach in the summer and come home, and the next morning I'd wake up and I'd break ice cube trays on a beach towel and wrap it up and put it on my head because I was so hungover and my head was killing me. And then a female bartender told me I didn't prepare to drink good enough. And, you know, at age 18, 17, don't drink a day at a time. Learn how to better prepare to drink. For me, I was, you know, still reaching. And she told me that I didn't coat my stomach. She told me that I needed to leave this big glass of water on my nightstand, and I needed to leave 2 Tylenols or Bayer aspirin out there. And when I came in from the night before, I needed to take these aspirin. I needed to drink, and it sounded like a good idea to me. She told me I had a dehydration problem, not an alcohol problem. And that sounded attractive. And, you know, I can't tell you how many nights I would wake up in the morning, and there'd be like empty white castle boxes on my night table, a couple of tall boys from 7-Eleven that I bought on the way home to drink. God knows where the water was. God knows where the aspirin were, you know? I mean, by the time I was 16, my mom had banned frozen pizzas in our house because we would stop at 7-Eleven and put them on at like 4 o'clock in the morning and then sit down to watch Pink Floyd The Wall and zone out. And my mother would wake up with all the smoke alarms going off, you know? And, you know, that's really how my life went. I lived to drink, and I drank to live. And, you know, my life never changed. And I really didn't know anything social that didn't revolve around drinking up until the time I was 23. I didn't know anything about living in life without drinking. I didn't know anything about going somewhere socially, whether it was boating or a baseball game or a funeral or a wedding or anything without drinking. I'd never been to any of those places where I grew up where it didn't just look like an excuse to drink. I mean, everything that I remember growing up always looked like just a better or worse looking place to drink. In my high school yearbook, there was this hokey section that I was too cool to fill out that said, I predict in 20 years, which back then seemed like eternity, and I just got an email from some moron telling me that my 20-year anniversary is in 2004. I didn't want to read that, you know? I don't even know how I got my current email address. But there were two predictions about me. One was St. John's Hospital will dedicate a wing to Billy N. And the other was Billy N will break every bone in his body, tear every muscle and ligament. At age 17, I thought that was a compliment. I thought that meant like that I was fun, I was a good guy to go to a party with. I thought it just said a lot of things. What I know today is that there were probably two people who knew a lot better about me at that age than I did. Because I stand here today, you know, I have no left kidney, I have no spleen. My ribs, I have a problem where as I drink until the wee hours of the morning, I pretty much lose, I stay awake, unfortunately, and I black out, and I lose motor control, except for my mouth. My mouth seems to have an innate ability to get better as the night goes on. And, you know, at 4 o'clock in the morning when you're lying on the ground in back of a bar in Long Island and you're, like, cuddled up in a fetal position trying to stop somebody from kicking you in the ribs again with steel-toe boots and you still can't shut your mouth, you know, this body has been pretty badly beaten up. And, you know, never any of it bad enough, I thought, to stop drinking. And, you know, for me, just so you know, and again, it doesn't make me an alcoholic, but, you know, at age 23, I had a really, really bad car accident, and I have a history of really, really bad car accidents, a long history. And I remember the first time, I love these slanted podiums because they remind me of the old fingerprint tables, you know, that had, like, the metal piece right here that held the card, and then it had the long roller where they rolled the ink before they had electronic and digital fingerprints. And, you know, I remember the first time I was arrested because I got away with a lot because of my dad. And this guy told me that I blew a .25 and that I shouldn't have been talking to him. And I said, hey, I'm the guy who drives everybody home, bud. You know, I'm the guy who stays up all night. You know, I'm the puke the next day guy. I never puke that night, you know. You know, and even when I look back at drinking games like quarters, you know, I remember the first time I had a quarter in my hand, and I was bouncing it off that kitchen table into a shot glass in somebody's house. And, you know, for me as an alcoholic, nothing was as painful as waiting for somebody to tell me to drink, you know. You know, and that it should be a punishment, you know. Like, you know, I just didn't even understand the whole premise that I'm supposed to be mad that you're pointing at me and telling me to drink, you know. To me, it was just painful to sit there and not drink, you know. But I had lots of bad car accidents, and but this one was very bad, and the other driver was killed. And that doesn't make me an alcoholic, you know. I love the line in the Big Book that says we're men and women that lost the ability to control our drinking. And the reason I like it is because there's a period there. It doesn't say we're men and women that lost the ability to control our drinking and went to jail and became homeless and got divorced or anything. There's just a period there. You know, and it really wasn't, I don't want to say it was, I wasn't glad to be back at AA. And I definitely wasn't glad to be back in AA when something that you told me could possibly happen happened. And I had really, really crossed the line with my family. You know, I'm often fond of saying that, the saying in Alcoholics Anonymous, you hear a lot, that nothing's worse than a belly full of booze and a head full of AA. But when you're a teenage alcoholic, a belly full of booze and a mom's head full of Al-Anon is a horrible combination. I mean, that's such a horrible combination, it's hard to even, like, put into words how bad a combination that is. See, because my mom had learned some tricks. I remember going to make a collect call once, and they wouldn't put me through. They said, oh, no, sir, that number doesn't accept collect calls anymore. See, because some horrible woman in Al-Anon had told my mother that she couldn't say no to my voice, that she needed to call the phone company, and she needed to put a block on collect calls. How horrible is that to teach people, you know? Teaching people to not take collect calls from their son. It's funny, you know, all these tough guys I meet in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, never call their mom for years, but get jammed up, and God, they just can't wait to call their mom. The other thing I learned that my mom learned in Al-Anon is, see, getting grounded in my house meant my mom went to bed at 9, I went out the window at 10, I came back in at 5, she went to work, she called me from work and said, you learned your lesson, I said yes. But you see, my mom learned this other thing. I learned that there's a very big difference between not allowed out and not allowed in. Not allowed in changes all the rules. Not allowed in is another, you know, drastic tactic that they taught her. Not allowed in, not having your own place to stay, whether it be a night, a week, or a month, is a whole new animal. And, you know, my family had pretty much had it with me, and you know, I wound up going to jail for that accident, and I wound up being sober. I was sober 5.5 months when I was sentenced, and I wound up going to meetings inside in Riverhead and Yaphank. And, you know, it's funny, I was sitting next to three kids the other day at a meeting who were behaving so bad, and it's funny because people who haven't been an inmate in a recovery meeting in jail have no idea. You know, I hear certain people talk about, oh, yeah, just to get cigarettes and whatever else. But if you've ever been in a place where there's people really getting sober, it's just not about that. In fact, when I first went to my first meeting in Riverhead, I was told flat out to not use movement inside the facility to go to a meeting as a way to carry contraband because that would jeopardize the meeting. And I was told that very strongly by an inmate member of that group. You know, it's funny that announcement was read tonight about the Working with Others anniversary. You know, my first step and my powerless over alcohol, I'm so powerless it's scary. I was. Today am I? I believe I've been given a power, and I'll go into that the next couple of weeks. I don't stand here today powerless. I stand here held up by the greatest power I've ever tapped into. Was my life unmanageable? Yes, and I was taught that means you need a manager. And, you know, my insanity, I think I talked about it, but I just want to make it clear that this alcoholic does not believe getting into a fight, climbing on top of a train, or jumping the fifth floor balcony down in Florida into a pool. I don't think that has anything to do with my second step, and that's me. My insanity is that standing on a 7-Eleven line, buying a pack of cigarettes, getting a big gulp because I can't feel my throat, the only thing that goes through my mind is, I can't wait to drink again, knowing what happened the night before. For me, the insanity is picking up that first drink when I am completely sober. I heard a tape of Bill Wilson, and he said, everybody does crazy things when they drink. The insanity in the big book is about picking up that first drink, and I believe what the doctor's opinion says. I have no defense, none, no defense after I take that first drink. The only shot I got is to find a spiritual condition in my life where I don't have to take that first drink. And some days that's harder than others. And I told you about miracles. I just want to say that I was sitting on a cot. I heard a speaker say, that sobriety time in jail doesn't count. And so I said, I'm not listening to any more speaker tapes. We were allowed to have Walkmans that didn't have AM, FM, that only had cassette. This is pre-CD. I'm really dating myself. So I hated it. I said, oh, everybody that has a tape is an idiot. He probably never even drank. And One day I was in the library in Yaphank where we had our meetings, and the tape box was there, and there was a tape, Tom I, Aberdeen, North Carolina, before he lived in Southern Pines, as the flyer says now. And for some reason I grabbed that tape, and I don't know why today. It's not me to question. But I know that I listened to that tape of a man who was 23 years old and killed two pedestrians drinking and driving. And now was the first person in the history of the United States to be a convicted felon and become a warden of a maximum custody penitentiary. And had had a family and a successful life and was still active in AA. This is not a rest on your laurels kind of program. It never has been for me. I mean, I'm only as active as I am today. I know that when I travel, I still need to have a meeting directory before I go there. I still need to know where the meetings are before I go. You know, I still feel like I'm uncool now. You know, I was thinking about it the other day. I unpacked my suitcase in L.A. 3 days ago, and I took, you know, my small big book in 12 and 12 were in my briefcase, and I took my daily reflections and as Bill sees it, and I put it on my night table. I mean, how uncool is that? I mean, that just is like the epitome of what I never wanted to be like. And but what I've learned is it's a small price to pay for the life I've been given today. And I've had the ability to meet Tom Ivester. He's almost like a dad to me. I see him all the time. And I'll close with this. I never wanted to become the most responsible person in my family either. I never wanted to become the moderate in my family. I don't know how those things happen, you know? They just come out of nowhere. All of a sudden, you're the person people look to. When I was 2 years sober, my grandmother died, and I remember being in that funeral home in Queens and walking downstairs to the smoking room, because I was still smoking about 2.5 packs of ports a day then, and my Aunt Sheila came in, and my Aunt Sheila was locked up most of my childhood. And my dad called her his crazy sister. And she came over to me, and she looked great. And I had heard that she got her master's and her doctorate at Columbia Teachers College, and she's a dean on Long Island at a college. And she said, "Billy, you know, I heard you got sober. Is that true?" And I said, "Yes, Aunt Sheila." And she says, "That's awesome, Billy." She said, "Is that guy upstairs with you from AA?" Because this guy at Chelsea Riverside had told me, "You're going to go to your grandmother's funeral. You're going to bring somebody from AA. You're going to be there for your dad because he's been there for you through life. And you're going to show up for the first time in your life and be a grandson and a son. You're not going to run away from this." And then she told me that she was, at that time, 14 years sober in AA and abstinent in OA. And that the lady upstairs with her, even though her family was there, she had someone from her home group. And it's funny, you know, it's not funny, but just let me tell you this. I buried my mom and my dad, and over the next couple of weeks I'll talk about how I struggled through that. But I don't think it's any mistake that at my dad's funeral, the person who gave the eulogy, me and the two readers, one in AA, one in AA and OA, and one in Al-Anon. The people that show up, the people that are able to hold it together. And by hold it together, I don't mean not cry. Now, I remember walking out of that church, and I remember the bagpipers playing and the police motorcycles there. And I remember this lady coming up to my sister and saying, "Don't cry, hold it in." You know, like, for me, the heaviest thing in the world is an uncried tear, because I didn't know how to cry when I came here. And at my mom's funeral, I had the ability to give the eulogy again and tell how hard it was for a very far from perfect son to give a eulogy for a very close to perfect mother. And how during my mother's 8 months of illness, which I was first so mad about, that 8 months is maybe the best 8 months of my life to date. That Christmas, 3 weeks before she died, probably the best Christmas I may ever have. All because I stayed sober. I would have had none of this had I been drinking, none of it. And, you know, as the weeks go on and we go through the steps, what I will do is use real-life experiences of when I have failed miserably and when the steps have rescued me and when the steps and AA and people in AA have carried me through some real hard times. You know, we always talk about the footsteps prayer, you know, but I love the, you know, the version, you know, of when the guy says, "Hey, you know, I look back and there's only one set and then there's a big, you know, hole in the ground next to me." And then that's when God says, "Well, that's when I dropped you on your ass." because you don't learn when I carry you, you know? You know, that's the footsteps prayer for Billy, you know? I never learned when anyone carried me, you know? What I was taught about Alcoholics Anonymous is that every other place I had went for help had taught me to be hard on others and easy on myself. And AA taught me about accountability and being easy on the loved ones around me and hard on myself. And that is the recipe that worked for me. I don't know about other people. I know that I haven't had a drink in, to me, what seems an unbelievable amount, but I close with this. I've gone to bed a lot of nights wanting to take a drink, and I've never woken up a morning wishing I had. That's just a fact of life since I've been sober and a member of this program. So I look forward to being back. I've had to have my secretary. She's like crazy. She wants to know. Some people in my office know what I do, that I'm in AA. Some don't. She just wants to know what is so important that every Thursday night I have my travel schedules, and she's known about this for months since he asked me, and I drive her crazy, you know? And then today, what happens? You know, the snowstorm comes. I thought she gave me 5 hours to get here, you know? But I look forward to coming back here and talking a little bit about the holidays and the tips that I was given in New York City on how to stay through the holidays sober, because this is a pretty tough time of year. And a lot of places where we're around where there's a lot of alcohol. So thanks. It's been really good to be here.